VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Earlier this year, the internet rumor mill buzzed with claims that the sun was heading into a long and deep period of dormancy because of a lack of observed sunspots. Over the past couple of months, the story has morphed into an apocalyptic scenario which predicts that the sun was about to enter something called a grand solar minimum, with decreased solar activity that could last for years. This, in turn, would plunge the Earth into a mini ice age with constant freezing temperatures, possibly causing famine and other devastating natural calamities. As the rumor spread online, scientists, including those from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reassured the public with facts that the sun wasn't going into an extended period of inactivity or a grand solar minimum, and that the Earth wasn't headed for another mini ice age. One thing the rumor did spark was curiosity about solar activity and something called space weather. So today, we'll talk with an expert to learn how the sun goes through periods of high and low activity, which is called the solar cycle, and about space weather. My guest, who joins us today via Skype, is Douglas Biesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center, located in Boulder, Colorado. Doug, I understand that the sun goes through a roughly 11-year period of activity called a solar cycle. What is it?
A solar cycle can be measured in many ways, although they all show the same 11-year period that you mentioned. The standard way we've been measuring a solar cycle for hundreds of years is to count sunspots. And in those 11 years, you have solar minimum when you have almost no sunspots, to solar maximum when you can have many, many sunspots.
Can you tell us what exactly is a sunspot? So how sunspots are generated? What do they do?
Sunspot is the thing you would be able to see if you could look at the sun with your naked eye. Don't recommend doing that, by the way. Do not look directly at the sun without proper protection, such as eclipse glasses. In fact, this morning, there is exactly one sunspot on the sun. It's so small, even with eclipse glasses, you wouldn't be able to see it. But sometimes there are sunspots that are so large, you can see them with your naked eye. And the reason you can see it is because they appear dark compared to the rest of the sun around it. Sunspots are cooler than the rest of the sun by about 500 degrees. And that's because they're regions of intense magnetic field that prevent some of the heat from the interior of the sun from getting out in that narrow region where these intense magnetic fields are.
What do sunspots have to do with solar activity and the solar cycle itself? Why are they so closely aligned?
So that alignment happens because of this fact that they are magnetic fields. They're showing us a picture of the strength and location of the solar magnetic field. And where it's strong, it produces solar activity that we monitor here at the Space Weather Prediction Center for solar flares, what we call coronal mass ejections, and other sorts of activity that are all associated with the intense magnetic fields and the energy that that releases. And that's why we see an uptick in what we release in terms of forecasts, watches, and warnings at solar maximum as compared to solar minimum.
And I definitely want to get into talking about space weather in a bit, but let's get back to the solar cycle. It's normally, as we mentioned, it's normally an 11-year cycle, but have there been unusually long or short cycles?
The average solar cycle is 11 years. It can vary by up to a couple of years, shorter or longer. It has in the past. So having a cycle that's 12 years or a cycle that's 10 years isn't anything that unusual. It's just that the average over the last 24 comes out very close to 11 years. Having said that, the intensity of the cycle, like how many sunspots we get at solar maximum, can vary from cycle to cycle as well.
A few scientists and internet activity recently suggest that the sun has been very quiet for the past at least 2 years, and there has been a little over 100 days this year when there were no sunspots at all observed on the sun. By the sun being quiet or little activity, what does this mean?
When there is very low activity, it generally it means there's a much lower risk of solar storms impacting the Earth. When we divide space weather into all of its sorts of phenomena, one of those does include high-speed solar wind. And the high-speed winds don't come from these sunspot regions. Instead, they come from what we call coronal holes, which are actually more numerous at solar minimum. And so from an impact perspective, solar minimum is a big concern for people that operate communication satellites at geosynchronous orbit, for example, can be impacted by these high-speed winds, or really the electrons in the environment of the satellite that are affected by the high-speed solar wind.
Doug, I understand that we're transitioning from one solar cycle to another solar cycle, and that because of the very little sun activity that we're in a solar minimum. However, word started to spread on the internet that the next solar minimum would be like few before it, some suggesting that the sun may be entering what is called a grand solar minimum. First of all, what is a grand solar minimum compared to a regular solar minimum?
A grand solar minimum doesn't really have a definition because, as far as we're aware, there's only been one, what we call the Maunder minimum. But in general, what we would expect if people are talking about a grand solar minimum is that we would go 20, 30, 50 years with no sunspots or very, very few sunspots on the sun.
So when was the last time? When was the one time that we had a grand solar minimum?
The one grand solar minimum that we're aware of, known as the Maunder minimum, occurred in the late 1600s from about 1645 to 715. So about a 60-year period where sunspots didn't disappear completely from the sun, but were very few in number without any evidence for a maximum in the cycle or a minimum in the cycle.
Doug, I understand a lot of people connect the grand solar minimum with what is called the Little Ice Age. Do you see that?
Yes, that's something that has been a connection that was made when Europe in general saw cooler than average temperatures for an extended period of time. And so that did get associated with the Maunder minimum. And of course, the sun plays a role in our temperature on the Earth. The impact of that is well understood. We know how much solar radiation we're receiving. In fact, the total amount of radiation coming from the sun changes by less than 1%. So even from minimum to maximum, what matters for affecting temperature on Earth is almost constant. It changes just a tiny, tiny fraction. But there are measurable impacts of that tiny change in solar output.
So does it look like we're in for another grand solar minimum? And as some people are saying, another ice age?
There's very little evidence that we are expecting to go into a grand solar minimum. In fact, there's sort of two points to make here. One is there wouldn't necessarily be any evidence that we were about to go into a grand solar minimum. As far as we can tell, solar cycles behaved normally right up until the Maunder minimum happened. And then there was no way to know when it was going to end until it ended and sunspots started reappearing. So that's at least what we know from surface observations. Maybe if we were to observe one now, when we have a better understanding of what's happening inside the sun, we would have some method of predicting this. So having said that we don't know, what we do know is by looking at the magnetic fields on the surface of the sun and the transport of those magnetic fields underneath the surface using something we call helioseismology. So just like seismology of earthquakes tells us about the Earth's interior, we do seismology on the sun that tells us about the interior of the sun. And we see the evidence for solar cycle 25 now in those data. And as far as we can tell, everything on the sun is behaving normally. The forecast for cycle 25, based on all the data we have, is for cycle 25 to be below average in intensity, but a healthy solar cycle.
Wasn't solar cycle 24 also kind of weak?
So cycle 24 was also kind of weak. And by that, what we mean is in the last 100 years, or, you know, count, and now we're talking solar cycles. So in 100 years, you get 10 cycles, well, nine really. And of course, being the lowest out of, you know, 10 maybe isn't that big a deal. But cycle 24 was below average. Our forecast for cycle 25, and this forecast was put together by an international panel that included researchers and forecasters from not every country in the world, but from representatives covering the globe from Japan and China to European countries, in the case of the UK and Germany and others in Europe and in the US. So it's a consensus, at least on the panel, that cycle 25 will be about the same as cycle 24 in intensity.
Do we feel effects of a solar cycle, like when there is minimum solar activity versus maximum solar activity?
So the average person, and by the way, I consider myself an average person, living at home, doing my normal things, no way, I cannot tell that there's a solar cycle. There is no impact on my life. And that's the way, that's good, right? Mm-hmm. Because in some ways that means we are doing our job. Having said that, certain industries feel the impact. And in extreme cases, people in places like Quebec, Canada, in Sweden, in South Africa, have had electrical power problems caused by space weather. There have been airline communication problems caused by space weather. If you use GPS for very high accuracy uses, by that I mean centimeter, then you're susceptible to space weather.
When was it discovered that there is such a thing called solar cycles? Because I understand it goes way back at least to the 1700s.
So in the late 1700s, we started to get consistent observations of the sun, enough that people were observing the sun and trying to count the sunspots almost every day. Prior to about 1750, people would notice sunspots on the sun. Occasionally, people would spend some time to count sunspots, but weren't doing it very regularly. So in the mid-1700s, around 1750, that started to happen. Observatories started taking regular counts of sunspots on the sun. And after 30 years of that, it became clear that, oh, hey, there's a solar cycle of about 11 years.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Today, on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we're talking about how the sun works and something called space weather. My guest who is joining us via Skype is Douglas Piesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center, located in Boulder, Colorado. Doug, I'm curious. I can understand tracking, measuring, learning all about the solar cycle with today's technology, but how were they able to do so back in the 1700s? How were they able to determine it? What technology was in place then?
So the technology was a simple telescope, typically with a filter or by projecting the image of the sun onto a piece of paper so that you could draw what you're seeing. In fact, you literally would trace what you see. And there's a semi-famous example of this. In 1859, an observer, Sir Richard Carrington, who was a hobbyist solar observer, but a serious one, he observed the sun every day about the same time of every day and would project a telescopic image of the sun onto a piece of paper and trace what he saw. Well, what happened in 1859 was he was in the middle of doing this, and all of a sudden, while tracing the sunspots, a bright feature appeared in the middle of his sunspot. And at first he thought it was a problem with his filter, some pinhole or something, but it was evolving. He actually noted the time that this occurred, drew a picture of what it looked like, ran off to find somebody to confirm it. By the time he got back, it was fading and almost gone. And so, in fact, he was observing a solar flare as it happened, but the sunspots, because they're there all the time, meant no matter when you looked at the sun, you could see those and draw images of that. So we have, or there are images of the sun and the sunspots on the sun, you know, going back many hundreds of years.
And I understand the technology that was used back then. And of course, here in the 21st century, we have all kinds of technology. We have spacecraft. We have more sophisticated telescopes. Can you tell us, Doug, what tools do you use to track the activity of the sun?
So when we're interested in tracking the activity of the sun for space weather, we're using satellites. We're using ground-based telescopes. We're using things that work at many wavelengths. So on the ground, we have optical telescopes, we have radio observatories. In space, we have instruments that are measuring the X-rays from the sun and the ultraviolet from the sun, those things that don't penetrate our atmosphere, that give us a picture of the sun, its surface and its atmosphere, so that we have all sorts of details about not just the sunspot, but the magnetic field and what is happening in terms of the solar flares and the coronal mass ejections and these coronal holes that are on the sun. But the counting of sunspots essentially happens the same way today that it did 200 years ago.
We were talking about a grand solar minimum. Is there such a thing as a grand solar maximum? And if so, has it ever happened?
I guess the short answer is no. One thing that's gotten a little confusing with the solar cycle is that about 5 years ago, the count of sunspots changed. And that's a very long story, but I think I can tell it briefly. So it turns out that the first person to really count sunspots had a set of rules for how he counted. And we have to have rules for everything. Oh, that spot only lasted for 30 minutes. Do I count it? Today we would say, no, we don't count things that don't persist for very long. What about something that is very small? What about the technology or the capability of the telescope they were using at the time? And so were they missing some small spots that they might have seen with a slightly better telescope? So it turns out the original counts of sunspots were low by a significant factor, about 40%, based on the rules that were being used. And it turns out then for about 250 years, we kept that scaling factor, even though we knew that a true sunspot count was really higher if you used modern counting rules. So about 5 years ago, the official center in Belgium for counting sunspots made the decision to go ahead and correct the sunspot number so it reflects the modern counting rules for sunspots. There were a bunch of other little effects mixed in doing that. So there was a large effort by the community to go back and literally even find the telescopes used, you know, hundreds of years ago to see how good they were, but also to assess the rules that any observer was applying in calculating sunspot number. Until 5 years ago, there was a wide belief that cycles really 17 through 23, so sort of the modern era, were much larger in a long period of very high activity. But when they went back and recalibrated the old numbers, it sticks out a lot less. And in a sense, it evened out the sunspot cycle quite a bit so that there really isn't. And at least this is my opinion. I wouldn't refer to any period as a modern maximum. And there's certainly no widespread acceptance of a modern maximum.
We've touched upon the solar cycle itself, and we've mentioned space weather a bit. Let's talk a little more about that, if we could. Can you define what space weather is? When we think of weather here on Earth, we think of sunshine, clouds, rain, snow, hail, so forth. What is space weather?
So space weather is the variability of the sun on short timescales. So here we're not talking about the solar cycle timescales or climate change timescales, but literally on timescales of seconds, minutes, days, and hours. And so we are monitoring the sun with satellites and telescopes continuously 24/7 for eruptions of solar flares, of coronal mass ejections, for evidence of the coronal holes that are going to give us high-speed winds so that we can issue accurate forecasts and issue the warnings to customers when these occur that they need to take action.
Doug, from what you're saying, it seems as though the sun itself is the sole component of space weather. Is that true?
That is mostly the case, that the sun is the sole factor for space weather. The only variation on that is if humans are going to go to a place like Mars, what your biggest concern for that is radiation levels. And radiation from the sun is only one component of that. It's what we call galactic cosmic rays. These are highly energetic radiation particles coming from outside our galaxy, even, are a bigger concern. The thing is, our sun, when it's at its maximum of activity, which you would think would be when radiation is at its worst, actually shields our environment from these galactic cosmic rays. Not completely, but it shields enough of them that it's a noticeable difference. And so from a radiation perspective, traveling to other planets, you would go when these cosmic rays are a minimum, which happens to be at solar maximum. But otherwise, from our perspective, all space weather concerns here on Earth are related to the sun.
You're talking about cosmic rays, and of course we talked about the effect of the sun on the Earth, and along with the sun protecting us somewhat from cosmic rays, what about Earth's magnetic fields? What impact do Earth's magnetic fields have on space weather?
So the Earth's magnetic field is really the thing that protects us from the particle radiation, the galactic cosmic rays and similar but lower energy radiation from the sun. So under normal conditions, the magnetosphere of the Earth's magnetic field protects us from this radiation. However, it's disturbances in this magnetic field caused by the high-speed winds or by the coronal mass ejection impinging upon the Earth that causes space weather. And the way to think about it is it's a magnetic field. And those of us that have played in a laboratory with magnets and wires to try to light a light bulb or generate an electric current in the wire by moving a magnet, that's what's happening in the Earth's atmosphere during what we call a geomagnetic storm, basically causing the Earth's magnetic field to vary both in intensity and direction. And then this drives electric currents in any sort of conductor, like the power grid or oil pipelines. And so that's, in fact, a very simple way that the magnetic field of the Earth both protects us from radiation, but then generates the impacts of space weather. Now, geomagnetic storms are only one of several types of space weather that we monitor. Solar flares send photons, basically light, X-rays, and ultraviolet out in massive bursts, that they affect the ionization of the atmosphere. And the reason that's important, for one, is if you use GPS, well, you're a GPS receiver, and you probably have one if you have a cell phone, if you might have a GPS in your car, that's communicating with satellites in space, the GPS or Galileo or BeiDou, depending on which country you're in, networks. To calculate your position, you have to know the exact distance between you and the satellites. But the signal from the satellite has to go through the Earth's ionosphere, and that means it doesn't actually follow a straight path. And so you have to know all the details of the ionosphere between you and the satellite to accurately determine your location. Your receiver, every GPS receiver unit has a model that does that correction for you, but it does that correction based on there being no space weather. When a solar flare happens, to change the ionization of the ionosphere, the satellite ends up appearing to be in a different place, and that gives you an error in your location because the model in your GPS receiver doesn't realize that the Earth's ionosphere has changed. It's only temporary. It might only last a few seconds to minutes, but if you're doing something with GPS at that time of high accuracy, it could be wrong.
I've read a couple of studies over the past couple of years that some scientists are speculating that Earth's magnetic field is actually decreasing. And on another hand, I understand also that the poles of the magnetic field are about to flip. Can you comment on both the weakening of the fields and the flip of the polarity of the magnetic fields?
I've probably read the same studies that you're referring to, which is the extent of my knowledge. Yes, there is clear evidence that the Earth's magnetic field has weakened ever so slowly over, you know, the past 100 years, for example. Not to the extent where it makes a big difference for space weather, though. Now, what that means for the flipping of the polarity of the Earth's field, what happens during the flipping of the field, I don't know anything about that. My understanding is that we don't really know how the flipping of the field works. But I think there's widespread belief that the Earth's field is always there. If the field disappeared completely during the flip, there would be evidence of the increase in the cosmic rays that would be impacting the Earth.
Doug, again, can you tell us why it's so important that we have a Space Weather Prediction Center, why we should be paying attention to space weather?
We're paying attention to space weather because it's making sure that the lights are staying on in our houses and in our places of employment. Commerce today is using GPS to do amazing things, from building roads to farming, that all depend on knowing when a space weather storm is happening. So there are huge elements of our economy related to the power grid and GPS, but even aviation. While we've been serving airlines space weather information for many decades, a brand new service for global aviation started in November of last year, where three global centers that are about to be four are coordinating forecasts for the airlines to make sure that radiation concerns, GPS concerns, and communication concerns of the airlines are all being alerted of all of that activity so they can take appropriate action.
Doug, thank you so much for taking time to join us today and for filling us in on solar cycles and space weather in general. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick. And anytime you want to talk space weather, feel free to call.
That was Douglas Biesecker, a physicist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center located in Boulder, Colorado. He joined us today via Skype. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today. And please be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.